Canto 10, chapter 66, verses 16 through 18. This is the chapter titled Paundrika, the False Vasudev. So let's do text 16 responsively, and then we'll do 17 and 18 together. Shulair gadabhihi parighai Shakti Rishti Prasatomarai Asivihi Patti Shairbanai Raharan Arayoharim Shulair Gadabhihi Parigaihi Shakti Rishti Prasatomarai Asivihi Patti Shairbanai Praharan arayoharim. Prabhus. Shulai gadabhi parigai. Shakti rishti prasatomarai. Asidhi patti shairbanai. Praharan arayoharim. Shulai gadabhi parigai Shakti rushti prasutomarai Asidhi patti shaibanai Asadihi patti shairbanai Praharam arayoharim Madalis Shulai gadabhihi parigai Shakti rishti prasatomarai Asadihi patti shairbanai Praharan arayoharim Shulai gadabhihi parigai Shakti rishti prasutomarai Asibhi patti shairbanai Praharan arayoharim Shulaihi with tridents, gadabhi, clubs, parighai, and bludgeons, shakti, pikes, rishti, a kind of sword, prasa, long barbed darts, tomarai, and lances, asibhi, with swords, pattishai, with axes, barnai, and with arrows, praharan, attack, arayaha, the enemies, harim, Lord Krishna. The enemies of Lord Hari attacked him with tridents, clubs, bludgeons, pikes, rishtis, barbed darts, lances, swords, axes, and arrows. Text 17. Krishna stuta paundraka kashi rajayor balam gajasyandana vajipattiman gadasi chakre shubhir arvayad bhrusham yatha yugante hutabhuk vithak vaja. But Lord Krishna fiercely struck back at the army of Paundraka and Kashiraj, which consisted of elephants, chariots, cavalry, and infantry. The Lord tormented his enemies with his club, sword, Sudarshana disc, and arrows, just as the fire of annihilation torments the various kinds of creatures at the end of a cosmic age. Purport. Srila Prabhupada comments as follows in Krishna. The soldiers on the side of King Paundraka began to shower their weapons upon Krishna, The weapons, including various kinds of tridents, clubs, poles, lances, swords, daggers, and arrows, came flying in waves, and Krishna counteracted them. He smashed not only the weapons, but also the soldiers and the assistants of Pandurga. Just as during the dissolution of this universe, the fire of devastation burns everything to ashes, the elephants, chariots, horses, and infantry belonging to the opposite party were scattered by the weapons of Krishna. Text 18. Ayodhanam tadrathavaji kunjara dvipat karoshtray arinava khanditai babhau chitam modavaham manasvinam akvidanam bhutapateribobanam. The battlefield, strewn with the dismembered chariots, horses, elephants, humans, mules, and camels that have been cut to pieces by the Lord's disc weapon, shone like the gruesome playground of Lord Bhutapati, giving pleasure to the wise. Purport. Srila Prabhupada describes this scene as follows. Although the devastated battlefield appeared like the dancing place of Lord Shiva at the time of the dissolution of the world, the warriors who were on the side of Krishna were very much encouraged by seeing this, and they fought with greater strength. Om Ajnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. This raises the question in the mind about the weapons that were used during those times and how those weapons compare to our times. It appears that the weapons seem primitive. I want to discuss that today. Krishna has traveled all the way from Dwaraka to Kashi to fight Pandurga and Kashiraj. He could just sit in Dwaraka if he had a laser-guided missile, a nuclear warhead or something, press a button and Kashi would be finished. Why does he have to get into his chariot, take so many soldiers, so many armies, and then go there? He's God, he's a supreme being. And why does he have to fight with primitive weapons like swords and pikes and lances and bow and arrows? Isn't bow and arrow something that the primitive societies use for battle? The hunters, the hunter-gatherers, isn't that the case? What kind of God is this? We are now so advanced. We can kill people from thousands of miles away by clicking a computer, a mouse click on a computer. So these questions arise in the modern age for the modern people who watch too many movies, I guess, like me. So, and people use these kinds of pastimes to reject Krishna's position. They consider him as an ordinary mortal human being because he's limited. He's using bows and arrows or whatever. And we have moved on. Our technology has advanced. And so Krishna was a human being. And then by extension, the Bhagavad Gita was spoken by a human being. And so on. So there is a fundamental problem with this reasoning, and I wanted to point out the logical issues with this. So this is a sophisticated version of Ardha Kukupi Nyaya. That means that we accept that Krishna fought with bow and arrow because it's in the Bhagavatam, but we don't accept anything else in the Bhagavatam. That's Ardha Kukupi Nyaya. We use something that you accept as true to reject Krishna as God, but you are not also accepting simultaneously the statements that prove beyond any iota of doubt that Krishna is God. And so that's a problem. You can't accept one thing and not accept the other. You have to accept both simultaneously and then arrive at a conclusion. That's the logical way of doing this. So there is a fundamental flaw in such reasoning. If we accept that Krishna did the rasa dance and he was immoral, and therefore we reject him, but if you accept the rasa dance, Prabhupada would say, you have to also accept that he had 16,000 wives, which human being can do that. You can't accept something and reject Krishna's position because that's illogical, that's absurd. So now let's come to why people do Ardha Kukupi Nyaya. By the way, this conclusion that Krishna is primitive is the bows and arrows and everything point to not a superior civilization, but that our civilization is superior. Such conclusions seem very logical. It's easy to dismiss them by labeling them as dumb or whatever. But they are very logical because Krishna's energy is designed to create those conclusions. We have to recognize that. And there are two verses I wanted to point out to support that point in the Bhagavatam. There's a verse in the 10th canto, chapter 20, verse 18. Dhanur viyati mahendram nirgunam cha guninyabha vyakte gunavyati kare agunavan purushoyatha. Since we're on the topic of bows and arrows, I thought this was an appropriate verse. Oh, you found it? You are fast. A machine. Dhanur means, maybe we look at the meaning, word meanings. Dhanu, the bow. Viyati, in the sky, Mahendram, which is Lord Indra, Nirgunam. Nirgunam, without qualities or without a bowstring. So what it means is that in the sky there is the rainbow. It looks like a bow, but it has no string. In the same way, Vyakte Guna Vyati Kare, in the manifest material nature, Krishna comes, but he is not material. This is the problem. The fundamental confusion in people's minds is that they don't know that although Krishna appears, and this is the Bhagavatam speaking, the same Bhagavatam that tells us that he uses bows and arrows, that when Krishna appears in material nature, he's not material. Just like the rainbow has no string, although it's curved. It looks like a bow, but it is not a bow. He looks like he has come into the material world and is interacting with the material nature, but he is purely spiritual. So this is the pitfall of interpreting Krishna's activities in the light of our own material conditioning, our own material experiences. It is natural. It is natural for somebody to say, but Krishna is a human being because he's fighting with bows and arrows. I mean, that's such a primitive technology. But the problem is that conclusion is made in the wrong intellectual framework because Krishna is not material. So, Prabhupada's purport to this verse is very nice. When the curved bow, this is not Prabhupada, this is his disciples. When the curved bow of Indra appeared in the sky, which had the quality of thundering sound, it was unlike ordinary bows because it did not rest upon a string. Similarly, when the Supreme Lord appears in this world, which is the interaction of the material qualities, he is unlike ordinary persons because he remains free from all material qualities, independent of all material conditions. Srila Prabhupada comments, sometimes in addition to the roaring thunder of the clouds, there is an appearance of a rainbow. Actually, a bow is in the curved position because it is tied at its two ends by the string, but the rainbow, there is no such string. Similarly, when the Supreme Personality of Godhead descends, he appears just like an ordinary human being, but he is not resting on any material condition. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that he appears by his internal potency, which is free from the bondage of the external potency. What is bondage for the ordinary creature is freedom for the personality of Godhead. That's a nice sentence. What means is, what is a bow and arrow for an ordinary creature is a spiritual weapon for the personality of Godhead. It's the bow and arrow and everything that Krishna has is not material. Now, the next verse actually also explains the reasons for our jumping to conclusions. And this is Nararaja Udupaschanna Swajotsana Rajita Irghanaihi Aham Matya Bhasitaya Swabhasa Purushoyata. Why are we confused? This is the verse. During the rainy season, the moon was prevented from appearing directly by the covering of the clouds, which were themselves illumined by the moon's rays. Similarly, the living being in material existence is prevented from appearing directly by the covering of the false ego, which is itself illuminated by the consciousness of the pure soul. What this means is that our problems with Krishna's pastimes have nothing to do with Krishna, they have more to do with our own ignorance. That means we are ignorant of our position, our own identity. Who is making the judgment that bows and arrows are superior or inferior to laser-guided weapons. It is the soul, or our identity is covered by the false ego, just like the moon is covered by the clouds. Therefore, all the conclusions we make about Krishna are wrong, are incorrect. They are bound to be, because we start from a position of ignorance. So all the conclusions that follow are incorrect. Now, one might say that, well, this is just a whole lot of sophistry, that you're making philosophical arguments, but the detail is left out. And the detail is that he's not using laser-guided weapons. But that's not true either. Well, he's not really using laser-guided weapons. But he's using weapons with inconceivable power. That's also described in the Bhagavad. So, one beautiful thing about Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta is that everything in the material world is a reflection of the spiritual world. There's nothing here that's not present in its pure form in the spiritual world, including laser-guided rockets and nuclear weapons, warheads and whatever. Except that the reflections in the material world are forwarded. So here's the evidence of that. Krishna's chakra, when Krishna releases his chakra, it follows the Ruvasa Muni all over the universe. It's guided, it's actually conscious. Not only is it not guided, but Krishna's weapons are conscious. Do we have any example of a weapon in modern world that's conscious? The Vishnu Jwara that we just discussed in Banasura's pastime, it speaks. And the Shiva Jwara speaks and offers prayers. These are weapons, but they're conscious. The chakra follows the Ruvasa Muni everywhere. Its job is not to just act as a hacksaw, but it's also making decisions of whether to kill or not. It's conscious. The Ruvasa Muni, it leaves the Ruvasa Muni alone. So that's just Krishna's weapons. But Arjuna, who is a Jiva, he has a Brahmastra. It's a bow and arrow, but with the mantra, he can destroy the whole universe. I don't think we've made a nuclear bomb yet that can destroy. I don't think we can, with the limited resources of the earth, that can destroy the whole universe with all its planets. So our weapons, if you examine the evidence from the Bhagavatam in that perspective, are very limited, extremely limited, because they are indiscriminate. Of course, people could say, well, why does God need to fight? He could kill with his inconceivable power without having to fight. Like I mentioned, that's a rasa tattva. So Krishna is fighting with Pandraka because Krishna wants to fight. He wishes to fight. That's also God's defining characteristic, is that he can do what he wants. And we may not necessarily understand it unless we take the time to hear from the acharyas. So, now what are the dangers of such reasoning? It might seem logical, it might seem innocent, it might seem that, you know, people take the point of view that we are rational and these religionists are irrational. And it's dangerous to follow religion because it gives you all kinds of strange ideas that can take us away from reality. So rationality and logic can be a very convenient refuge, a convenient shelter. But there is a problem with that. So I want to make the point of when we use logic to question things, points that are given to us about Krishna, how that can backfire. And I'll use Arjuna's example to do that in the Bhagavad Gita. So the chapter 11 in the Bhagavad Gita is not discussed much, at least I don't hear a lot of speakers touch on it, and I like that chapter very much, so I'll talk about it in the rest of the time today. In the 11th chapter, there comes the verse, Divya Aneka Udyata Yudham. Divya is divine. Udyata is raised. Ayudham is weapons. Krishna's weapons. Krishna is showing his universal form to Arjuna. And in that universal form, Arjuna is seeing Krishna's weapons raised. And he sees Aneka Vaktranayanam, Aneka Adhuta Darshanam, Aneka Divyabharanam, Divya Aneka Udyatayudham. He sees many, many thousands of heads and Aneka Bahu Daravaktranetram, Pashyami Tvam Sarvato Anantarupam. He is stunned by the vision that Krishna provides. Here is this person who was on a chariot with two hands, two legs, two eyes, beautiful form. And now he's become this terrible form. Akhyahi meko bhavan ugra rupo. Ugra rupa. He's become an extremely terrifying form. That Arjuna is completely, his composure is completely shattered. Every side he's seeing eyes and legs and mouths and bellies. And he's seeing weapons. Kiritinam gadinam chakrinam chatejo rashim sarvato deeptimantam pashyami tvam dur niriksham samanta deepta nilarka dhitim aprameyam. He's seeing these kiritinam, helmets or crowns, gadinam, gada, the mace, chakrinam, so many different chakras. And not only are they just weapons, but they're glowing with brilliant light. They're so terrible that he's not able to see. Even though Krishna has given him divine vision to be able to see it. So, they are blazing with fire and light. And then Arjuna tries to give analogies to explain this vision. In one place he says, and this verse was used by Oppenheimer, who was the architect of the nuclear bomb project in the US, which ultimately resulted in the bomb on Japan. And this verse, and I think I took it from Wikipedia, I'm just going to quote Oppenheimer on this point, let's see if I can find it. Maybe I deleted it. Let's see. Yeah, I don't have it here for some reason. Anyway, so what's the verse? The verse is Divi Surya Sahastrasya Bhavet Yugapat Uttita Yadibhaha Sadrushi Sasat Bhyasastasya Mahatmanaha. If you just close our eyes for a minute and imagine this scene, there are thousands of suns that are rising up in the sky from all sides of us, all sides of Alachara. What will it look like? Thousands of suns simultaneously. Yugapat. If you imagine this, you can imagine the brilliance of that form. So Arjuna is trying to convey to us what it looked like. Divi Surya Sahastrasya Bhavet Yugapat Uttita. If that happened, then that would perhaps be similar to Mahatmanah Bhasastasya, the brilliant light, radiance of Krishna's universal form. So what is Arjuna's reaction to this? Arjuna is afraid, like we should all be. Arjuna is in front of Kashiraj, Krishna is in front of Kashiraj Pandraka, and they're coming out to fight him. But when Arjuna sees what Krishna really can be, or at least a small aspect of Krishna's form, that scares even Arjuna. So he says, what's the starting of the verse? Bhayena pravyathitam manome tadeva me darshaya deva rupam prasida devesha jagannivasa. Let me find it. I can't remember the start of the verse, but. But bhayena pravyathitam me. He used this word pravyathitam many times in the 11th chapter. Once he sees this form, that I have lost my composure. My mind is shaking. I'm extremely afraid. Pravyathitas tathaham. I am afraid, and also the others are afraid. Who are the others? All the demigods are afraid. All the three worlds are shaking. You're burning up all the three worlds with the worlds with your effulgence. So when Arjuna sees this reality of Krishna, which is this magnificent vision containing everything that's sacharachara, moving and non-moving, everything in the universe, whatever you want to see Arjuna see, Krishna says, see in this form. And the tremendous power, thousands of suns rising up simultaneously, that's the brilliance. Dur niriksham, he's unable to see, it's so difficult to even with his divine vision see this tremendous power that Krishna manifests. And he's seeing all these warriors, Dronam cha Bhishmam cha Jayadratham cha Karanam datha anyan api yodha viran maya hatanstam. I have already killed them. Jahima vyathishtha. So don't worry. Yudhyasva jetasi. Fight. I have already killed them. And he's seeing all these warriors stuck in the teeth of the universal form and their heads are being crushed. Churunita uttamangahi. The heads are being crushed in the teeth of this universal form. So it's such a terrible vision. Krishna explains, Kalosmi, I am time, the great destroyer of all the worlds. Lokukshaikrutpravruddho. That Arjuna becomes afraid, and when he becomes afraid, how does he react? He says, Saketi matva prasabham yaduktam. He Krishna, he Yadava, he Saketi. Ajanata mahimanam tavedam maya pramada pranayanavapi. He becomes apologetic. Sorry for all the offenses I have done to you, because you are this, and I was thinking you are a human being. You are my friend, Vasudev. You are my beloved friend, and I joked with you. Yaccha vasartham asatkritosi vihara shayya sanabhojaneshu. Eko athava api achyata tat samaksham tat shame tvamaham aprameyam. Please forgive me for my foolishness, my offenses at your feet, because you are this. You are the source of everything that moves. Pitam, pitasi lokasya characharasya. You are the father of all the worlds. Tvamasya pujyascha gurur gariyan. You are the true worshipable guru. Natvat samasti abhyatika kutanya lokatrayapi papratima tadhava. Compared to you, there is nobody anywhere in the three worlds. Your influence is more than anybody else. Your power is greater than anybody else. So what am I doing considering you as my friend? I'm nothing. You are everything. He becomes extremely moved and repents his offensive behavior. Of course, we understand Arjuna's real position. But I'm just saying that if we are callous and careless enough to reject, because of our logic, the presence of God, the existence of God even, and we question the scriptures which describe God for our benefit and his pastimes for our benefit, we extrapolate our material experiences onto the scriptures and reject the scriptures because they are illogical or irrational, then one day we will be reduced to this. We will see that we are insignificant and we have offended, we have become offensive to Krishna. Who is this magnificent person that encompasses everything in this world? Aham krishnasya jagataha prabhavaha pralaya tatha. I am the origin of this world, but I am also its destruction. The fire of destruction was mentioned in this verse. So I destroy everything also. Krishna's power is immeasurable. It is so vast that we cannot begin to imagine it. And even if it is shown, like it was shown to Arjuna, he cannot begin to comprehend. Not only is he not able to comprehend, he becomes afraid. He loses his composure and he doesn't want to see it. I don't want to see this. Kiridnam gadinam chakrahastam ichhami tvam drashtum aham tathaiva teneva rupena chaturbhujena sahastrabaho bhava vishvamurte. This thousand hand form I don't want to see. Please become your kiridinam gadinam chakrahastam, your four handed form. Shankha chakra gadaparna. Show me that form. I cannot handle this. So we reject Krishna, we reject the scriptures at our own peril. What is our logic compared to this magnificent vision? So when the temptation arises to make judgments on the scriptures, let's ask ourselves, are we making conclusions that are logical based on the entire scriptural argument, all the information that's in the scripture, not just a small part of it and then reject it, and therefore by definition everything else is wrong? No, if we say that Krishna is ordinary, well then explain also how an ordinary person can live over the hill. If you can't do that, then let's hold our conclusions for now. Let's go further, go deeper, practice the philosophy and we'll come to understand. So this is a fundamental mistake, but also very, what appears to be rational mistake that a lot of people make in the modern age when they approach scripture. So I wanted to conclude here, and any questions, comments? Sishapu?
Thank you, Hari. You were talking about becoming offensive. At what point does do we become offensive as opposed to just ignorant, or is ignorance an offensive position to start with? At what point do we cross the line that we can say we're actually offensive?
When we are presented with knowledge of the scripture, Prabhupada presents it as a science. So what does Prabhupada say? What is Krishna's first instruction in the Bhagavad Gita? That you are the soul. When we are presented with this information, if we say no, that's not possible, even though we haven't taken the time and effort to actually perform the experiment Prabhupada is welcoming us to, asking us to do, to confirm whether it's true or not. If you refuse to, we reject something outright without considering the possibility and insist that this world is without foundation, that everything comes about purely through interaction of matter with matter, like Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita in the 16th chapter, then we are offensive. That's my take on it. If we are offered information and we are told, consider this possibility and here is an experimental program that you can follow to test it for yourself, whether it's true or not false. If somebody says, well, okay, it's possible, but I don't want to do it, that's not offensive. But if somebody says, no, it's not possible, that's wrong, that there is no such thing as the soul, then I think it's offensive because you are you're rejecting God and the possibility of God even. To consider the possibility of God and to explore it is one thing. And then maybe your experiences lead you to reject, you know, to say, well, there is no God. I tried and it didn't work. But to reject it without considering that there might be a method to achieve Him is a problem. Sishma?
If God is fundamentally different than us, then at what point does... we're in ignorance. He's trying to enlighten us. Isn't it natural that we're resistant to His mercy? So, I guess at what point does He become merciful to those that are offensive against Him?
Well, I mean, Krishna never stops being merciful to anybody, no matter what the offense. Even when He hurls them into the hellfires or whatever in the 16th chapter, there is still the option to come back, and we have statements in the scriptures that the devotees even go to hell to help. So the mercy never stops. But I guess what I'm trying to say is offensiveness begins with logically knowing that something is possible, but being determined to reject that possibility because of ulterior motives. So for example, if somebody said that, you know, God may exist and God may not exist, I don't know. And somebody approaches us like that, and here is a program that you can do to follow it, and then you insist that you are misguiding people, you're false, this is not true, there is no program, because you haven't tried it, so you're not in a logical position to say that that's false, right? If somebody, like I said, takes up the program, has bad experiences in Krishna consciousness and goes away, I will not categorize that person as offensive. I would say, okay, he tried, that was a casualty of war, and then another life, take it up. But when we insist on rejecting something without and knowing fully that there is no logical reasoning behind it, that we are wrong, knowing fully, rejecting it, and the problem is that people who are logical and rational can come up with a very rational, logical argumentation to persuade others, innocent people, to give up God and reject God. And that's even worse. Okay, you reject it on your own, that's offensive, but now you're taking, this is the issue of Upanishad, avidya and vidya. And that's the problem. That's offensive. One should not speak about God unless that is one's expertise. Yeah. Have you examined the evidence for God? Have you understood the fundamental logical presentation of Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta? The fundamental logical presentation is that Krishna is not material, that the soul is not material, that matter is a world which is temporary and it will not lead us to God, that we need a spiritual process to achieve God. So here is a spiritual process. Chant Hare Krishna. Are you willing to do it? Now, if somebody says that, okay, it's possible, but I'm not interested, that's not offensive. That's just misfortune. But a lot of people are not like that. A lot of people take the veneer of logic and rationality and deliberately act illogically, make arguments that reject outright without considering the sophistication of the presentation of Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta. Yes, Prabhupada.
So earlier you were speaking about the fundamental questions modernists ask, like, you know, rejecting the Vedic system as being ancient and prehistoric and so forth. But in one sense, this is the output of this scientific war, this so-called scientific war. You see, they actually deem the past cultures as being prehistoric and ignorant and so forth because of their wrong conclusions. You know, everything, the universe itself, originate by itself, the Big Bang and all ridiculous theories, and then origins also, so much religion. So from a scientific point of view, we see the world, we see the scripture differently. We see them as being, this is the weird imagination of some man that has written it, and so forth. So really, so this is what's left now. So for us now to enlighten them and to sometimes chastise them, especially, that's why Srila Prabhupada was so, what should I say, heavy on the scientists, because of their misguiding society. You know, they're totally misguiding society. And the whole, those that are not even scientists, but have studied a little bit in school, and so they come up with the same kind of conclusion. All this thing is prehistoric and fable and this and that. So it's, that's
Well, this can turn into a very long debate. But science is not evil. It's not evil. Science, the professional science, is not evil. The professional science uses material evidence to come up with material explanations of material phenomena. If you want to educate the scientists, people have to get into their own field, examine the evidence, and explain the evidence better than they can. But the problem is that the scriptures don't give evidence. Don't talk about the evidence, for example. Well, in many cases. I mean, the whole knowledge that's present in the textbooks of biology and chemistry and physics is not present in the Srimad Bhagavatam. For example, quantum mechanics. Well, there are aspects of the material world. There are aspects of the material world that are described in the Bhagavatam, but they are not comprehensible to us. They are not comprehensible to us. For example, I've had this debate recently with devotees, but if you look at the sixth canto, the sixth chapter, Kashyapa Muni is a man and he has a wife. The wife's name, he has many wives. There is Kadru. Kashyapa and Kadru have children, snakes. So here are human beings that are having children, which are snakes. Other children from other wives, Kashyapa Muni has birds, beasts, tigers, lions. Now, we don't have experience that human beings can give birth to snakes. So what I'm trying to say here is that the evidence, the explanations of the Bhagavatam are from a point of view that are not understood by us. They cannot be. the solar system, for example, cosmology. Now, the reaction of the rational, logical people is, no, these are all wrong. And that's a nonsensical reaction. But at the same time, the reaction that quantum mechanics is wrong, or that there's no such thing as an oxygen or hydrogen because it's not mentioned in the Bhagavatam, is also wrong. The Bhagavatam is not concerned with mechanistic explanations of the world, of the natural world. The Bhagavatam doesn't discuss evidence about T-Rex. It doesn't discuss evidence of nuclear reactions occurring during fission or fusion. It doesn't. So the scientific method of analysis has revealed information about the material world that's not present in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam gives a vision of the material world that we cannot understand with our limited senses. So my approach to this is both are true. Simultaneously and inconceivably, both are true. But to use science to reject the Bhagavatam is offensive behavior. It is offensiveness because it's offensive to Krishna, basically. To reject him based on logical, rational, and so the science is conditioned. It is working on under the limitations of the material senses. We cheat, we are illusioned, the senses are deficient, they are limited, right? But within the conditioned, limited view of science, science does pretty well and explain the evidence. But it can say nothing about God, and it can say nothing about absolute reality. It can't say anything about that. Absolute reality in the Bhagavatam is spoken from a perspective that is of the demigods and of Krishna, and we can't reject it either. Both are simultaneously true. I don't like either approach, rejecting the Bhagavatam for science, nor rejecting science for the Bhagavatam. Because what that does is, it raises the barriers for getting into Krishna consciousness for the world's people who are scientifically educated. Our children are going to school and they're learning science. They're going to come to us and ask us that, why are you rejecting science? This makes sense. Here is the evidence. Here are the theories. Can you explain this evidence in any other way? We won't have answers. It's not on.
Why don't they have a theory that there, the possibilities that there's some superpower also exists? Rather than say
science cannot. Listen, yeah.
Why? I mean, they say that, you know, like Big Bang theory, you know, like all matter was one place and they expand and things like that. Why are they trying to postulate that the whole world is going on?
I'll explain. Every theory in science is used to explain evidence. It is not, it has no other reason to exist. The Big Bang theory, hold on. The Big Bang theory is used to explain the evidence that's present in the motion of the planets. Now, have you examined the evidence? No. Can we say the Big Bang theory is wrong? No, because we're not even qualified to know what the evidence is saying. Science has used the Big Bang theory to explain the evidence, not to reject God. But scientists who are atheists are using the Big Bang theory to reject God. That distinction has to be made. The theory is dead matter. Theory has nothing to do with God. It makes no, the God is not in the analysis. They're just using calculations of motions of planets to trace out what's happening. It seems like a good explanation from the material deficient senses. From the material conditioned senses, it looks like a good explanation. But to use a material knowledge to reject the explanations of how the universe was created in the Bhagavatam is wrong. Because the Bhagavatam gives reality which is beyond the material perception. But at the same time, to say that the Big Bang theory is wrong because it is rejecting God is also not, we don't reject the evidence, we reject the conclusions. I'm not going to stand in front of a physicist audience, I'll be laughed out of court because their explanations are, I have to have an alternative explanation for the evidence. If I don't, I have no standing. Exactly. So we reject the science's conclusions, we don't reject the evidence. See, problem is these two things get conflated. Microphone? This might get too long. Maybe we should have a separate discussion on that. I think he had a hand up, yes.
You're a cell biologist, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, your research, this is basically the fundamental building blocks. I mean, can you see God in the construction of the cell? Or, I mean, are you looking? Or, I mean, is
okay,
that
so
lead in that direction or what?
The way I will answer this is based on Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta. Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta, and I can prove this, says the following. It is not possible to see God with a material process. Purely material process, it's not possible to see God because God is transcendental. So, what we speak of material science, which is a pure speculative, evidence-based method, karma yoga can't be used to see God. Ashtanga yoga can't be used. The only method with which one can perceive God and realize God and reveal God is bhakti. Bhaktyaham ekayagraya. Bhaktyamam abhijanati. Only bhakti, which is a transcendental processes give transcendental results. Material processes give material results. So if you ask me as a biologist sitting on the microscope, do I see God? No. Because God refuses to be revealed to a material process. That's a pure material process. It has nothing to do with transcendence. Naham prakashah sarvasya yoga maya samavritaha. I'm not revealed to everybody. God reserves the right to be covered to us perpetually. No matter how many material experiments we might do in the material scientific world, we'll never reveal God. And this is Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta. So to ask the question, can the scientist with the evidence discover God? I would say no. Impossible.
Right, but many scientists claim that they believe in God because they're scientists and because they see the wonder of the universe and the wonder of the mechanics of the cell and things like that. I mean, that's
scientists don't operate in a vacuum. They operate in a society where Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, etc. already exist. The only way one can believe in God is Shraddha, and that Shraddha is transcendental. That comes from devotees. Shushrusho Shraddhadhanas Sevasudeva Katharuchi. Only by the association of devotees can one get some faith in God. So scientists don't operate in a vacuum, but science does. The knowledge of science has no mention of God anywhere. There are hundreds of thousands of papers published. Science has a life of its own. It's a body of knowledge that excludes God by its very hypothesis. It only concerns itself with natural laws and natural explanations. So, can science reveal God? No, because there is no God in science. God is excluded from science by definition. But can scientists believe in God? Yes, but that's not because of the process of science, which is material. It's because of the association of devotees they're getting somewhere in the world. They don't live in a vacuum. Mataji, you had a question?
One cellular biologist by the name of Bruce Lipton,
mm-hmm.
he wrote the book The Science of Belief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I haven't read it, no.
He apparently, in the beginning, you know, he tells his story, and he was an atheist, but he became a theist. Now, are you, by your comment, would you conclude then that he became a theist? He became to believe in the supernatural? Is that, I know that's not... that's not that he came to Krishna, he came to understand the personality of Godhead, but he came to believe supernatural phenomena.
So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that, I'm not just talking about personal Krishna, I'm talking about Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan, all three are transcendental. This Shankaracharya also used this, Ramanujacharya also used these arguments. You cannot know Brahman, Paramatma or Bhagavan with material processes. Now, when people say that they believe in God, it was pointed out to me by devotees that they can mean many things. They don't mean Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan. Somebody might say, I see God in the laws of the universe. Now what kind of vision is that? I don't know what that means. So it's hard to map out when somebody, atheist becomes a theist because of scientific arguments, whether it's actually falling into Brahman Paraman Bhagwan, or it's falling into some imaginary, I don't know what to call it, what conception, that, it's not very clear to me. But I can say that nobody operates in a godless vacuum in the world. Even scientists are well aware of God. They know there are churches, they know there are temples, they can eat prasad by mistake on campus. So, it's hard to know.
So scientists, when they cut open an orange and they see that there's organization there, they don't see that.
Okay,
I mean, they start looking at the different types of, you know, analyzing the different things.
Components, right.
You can't see that the sun's going up and going down.
No.
That seasons, that there's planets, that there's organization.
I'll give you my example. I study organization in biology. And I can explain the organization based purely on random processes. And you can, if you came to my lab, I can show you structures, beautiful structures, more complex than oranges. Okay? That are assembled purely from molecules. Scientists are interested in how embryos develop. There's a whole field of developmental biology where they're asking, well, how did this hand come about? And why? Where did these fingers come about? Where did digits come about? And they have molecular explanations for it. They may be wrong. Nobody claims in science that they know the absolute truth. But the explanations are feasible explanations, self-consistent, for all the evidence that's available. So it is not that the scientists are unable to grasp that everything is, that the molecules can't form greater structures. They actually observe it in real time happening. If you look at this temple, if it was in a cell, you could actually see the temple being assembled in front of your eyes, and you don't see any invisible hands assembling it. And the reason for that is molecular processes and molecular interactions that are well understood. You can simulate it on a computer. So, again, I'm saying that the way to reconcile the sciences and spirituality is to keep them separate. Sciences operate in a lower level, on a material level, where they are dealing with the conditioned senses. And science is superbly well in explaining the evidence with all kinds of theories that we will have a tough time explaining otherwise with our own theories. Science is only concerned with the evidence. It's not concerned with theological questions, ultimate motivation, all this stuff. When the sciences are used and misused to reject God, we have a problem with that. If the sciences say that there is no soul, we have a problem with that. Because the sciences, material processes cannot say anything about Brahman. Material processes cannot say anything about Bhagavan, about Paramatma. So that's where the battle has to be fought. If we try to fight the battle with scientists on their ground, trying to reject their evidence, to reject their theories, we're going to lose. It's a losing battle. Because science has mutated into a monster that's way beyond any scientist's control. Science is a collective activity, and the evidence of science has been generated from hundreds of thousands of papers. We would have to go into each of those papers, examine the evidence, and come up with an explanation based on the Bhagavatam to explain the evidence. But the problem is the Bhagavatam doesn't talk about these things. It doesn't talk about oxygen. It doesn't talk about hydrogen. So the relationship between the Bhagavatam and the sciences is pure speculation from our standpoint. If we try to use the Bhagavatam to reject the evidence, we can. And Prabhupada didn't reject the evidence, which explains his ambivalence on various things, like the moon landings. Sometimes he said, we did go to the moon. Okay, we may have gone to the moon, so what's the point? Other times he said, no, we cannot, we never went to the moon. How do we explain the ambivalence? The way I do it is I say, Prabhupada is not rejecting the evidence that we went to the moon, but Prabhupada is rejecting the conclusion that we went to the moon. There's two different things. The conclusion that we went to the moon, based on the definition of the moon in the Bhagavatam, is that it must be a higher dimensional planet with cities and with living beings. And so you didn't go to the moon. Conclusion's wrong. The evidence is you went to the moon. Okay, yeah, so what? What's the use? You found barren rock, you wasted all this money, so what? Prabhupada was not an astronomer. He didn't sit down and calculate the trajectories, and he didn't have the expertise to reject the evidence. If you went to Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, do you say oxygen is real? Prabhupada has nothing to say. He's not interested in this. All he's interested is in Siddhanta. Are you rejecting the Bhagavatam? If you are, you're a rascal. But he also said, if the scientists accept God, we give them all credit. So we have to present ourselves. Our audience for preaching is going to be scientifically educated. No matter who it is. You go to India, everybody's children are going to getting a scientific education. If we present ourselves as our sacred duty is to chastise scientists, we are alienating an audience, entire audience. It is not good strategy in my view. But we have to pound the point that science is limited, it's material. It can't tell you anything about spiritual reality. This way we lower the bars for people to join Krishna consciousness. As it is, it's difficult to join Krishna consciousness. 16 rounds, we all know that. Now we raise the barriers astronomically high by saying you have to reject the sciences before you'll accept Krishna consciousness. It's a failing strategy in my view. It won't work. Our own children are getting scientific education. We have to be very clear on the relationship between the two, in my view. Robert, you have something to say?
Everything can
be exactly, yes.
Just ask the sutras, the beauty that they are. So being a Gaudiya Vaishnava, you should be able to see Krishna there and there.
It is not a question of what I am seeing.
Yes.
Krishna says, Rasoham apsukante, prabhasmi shashi surya yoho. I'm not answering the question from my point of view. I'm answering the question from the point of view of Siddhanta. Can a purely material process with no other injection, nothing else, by itself, can it reveal God? The answer is no. Only bhakti can reveal God. And once it reveals God, we see God in everything. Right? But we don't know how God is working. But that's my point, is that I'm not convinced that the approach to that is to challenge the evidence, because the Bhagavatam has to be used to inject the soul into the debate. We have to introduce transcendence to the scientists, not fight with them on material evidence, because that's a losing battle. One person can't fight an establishment that has, I don't know how many, millions of papers in the field. I mean, it's an impossible odds to reject science. And it's everywhere in our society. Every child is learning it. Our approach should be, no, it's not only matter, it's spirit. And that's Krishna's first teaching to Arjuna. Krishna didn't come down to Arjuna's material platform to argue with material things. He introduced transcendence into the debate. And that's what our responsibility is to say we reject that there is only matter acting on matter. How we will do it depends on the expertise that we may or may not have. But we have to be careful about, because it's easy to pound the scientists. But we have to understand Prabhupada's motivation for why he was pounding scientists, not just pound scientists because Prabhupada pounded scientists. He pounded for a reason. He was pounding the Siddhanta of science, not the evidence of science. Do you conclude? Maybe this is...
Well, we're saying that Prabhupada alone, but all his disciples, or most of his disciples, are taking the same step also. And for you, in one sense, to be glorifying science on that Vyasasan is not good at all, because they're totally misdirecting and misleading the world in so many ways. You know, I mean, we agree that there's so many achievements and so forth, but the conclusion is they're misdirecting society.
So I'm not glorifying science. I'm in fact saying science is inferior to the spiritual sciences. I'm saying that science is conditioned, that science can say nothing about absolute reality. So I'm not actually glorifying science, I'm putting it down. At the same time, I'm recognizing what's a logical fact. And the logical fact is that science is explaining things. We can't reject it. You live in a scientific world. Our approach is not a Gyani's approach. Your approach is a Gyani's approach. You reject the sciences. No, we use the sciences for Krishna's service. That's actual bhakti.
I mean, everything is zero.
Absolutely.
Without God and the soul, everything else is...
But you have to understand, science is limited. Science can say nothing about the soul because it's a condition...
But they should say they don't know about God and they know about soul.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they should. That I'm not advocating atheism on this Vyasa Asana. If I was, then that would be offensive. Hare Krishna.